This episode discusses violence, homophobia, hate speech, and hate crimes. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line.
I've only met a couple of people that have that light in them. My mom was one of them too, but my uncle was just so much brighter. I've never actually met anybody who could just make anybody feel good about themselves. And he just always gave you a compliment or asked you how you were doing. I mean, he just genuinely cared about everyone. It's hard to explain. He literally was a ray of sunshine. Like, you could feel his presence in a room without even seeing him walk in. You could just feel the light. He just shines so brightly, which is hard for us to understand how or why somebody would do this to him.
In 2021, we're going to do something a little different. Throughout the year, we'll leave the borders of the Southeast to bring you national cases of the missing, the murdered, and the unidentified. While we will always concentrate on the southeastern United States, there are so many families out there and so many cold cases that haven't gotten media attention or proper investigation, or sometimes either of those things. Perhaps a bigger platform can help in their resolution. With that, we start in Texas. It's a lot of ground to cover. On its own, the Lone Star State is half the size of the southeastern U.S. combined, and its population is close to 30 million. With sprawling cities and wide stretches of land, it's an easy place to get lost. The murder of Juan Leon Lareles, who everyone knew as Leon, didn't take place in one of Texas's metro areas. Leon lived and worked in Brown County, in the west central area of the state. Brown County is home to less than 40,000 people. The land is the ancestral home of the Pinatubo Band of the Comanche, and it's now named for a commander who led Texan troops against Mexican forces at the Battle of Velasco. The area is heavy on agriculture. Farming, cattle, dairy, plenty of jobs in the industries that crop up alongside agribusiness, too. The biggest settlement in the county is Brownwood, and smaller towns are scattered around it. They have names like Early, Bangs, Blanket, Crosscut, May, Zephyr. At the time of his death, Leon Lareles was living in one of those little towns, in Bangs, with his older brother George. Leon was 30 years old and working the graveyard shift at a local Kroger grocery store. He was a well-loved, punctual, and trustworthy employee who always showed up on time for his shifts. On the night of May 10th, 1996, he was due at the store at 12 a.m. According to his family, he left his brother George's house at about 11:30 p.m. Per the Brownwood Bulletin, Leon lived just 6 miles west of the Kroger. The drive should have taken no longer than about 15 minutes. And Leon did make it to the Kroger, at least according to his coworkers who saw his car outside. Leon's family told us as much. It was a distinctive vehicle, a 1988 Ford Thunderbird, which employees had spotted sitting out in the parking lot. But Leon never walked inside. And soon, though no one is quite sure when it happened, his car disappeared from the Kroger lot, with Leon's 12 a.m. shift time passing without his arrival. And then a call came in to 911. By 12:30 a.m., Leon's 1988 Ford Thunderbird would be spotted by motorists about 4 miles away. According to the Abilene Reporter News, the car sat off the side of a rural road near a gun range. It had been set ablaze. When local firefighters arrived on scene, they discovered Leon's body. He was laying on the ground near a fence that ran along the front of the gun range. He'd been shot once, quote, execution style. Witnesses reported seeing a, quote, white flatbed late model truck near the scene. According to a Crime Stoppers bulletin released just after Leon's death, that same truck, which had a distinctive trailer hitch, had rolled along after Leon's Thunderbird up the shoulder of the farm road. It wouldn't be long after that that Leon's car was set on fire and his body would be found. That was May 10th, 1996. Leon's case has been unresolved for nearly 25 years. His name never made national headlines, but plenty of people in Brown County remember Leon's story. Some even think they have a pretty good idea who might have committed the crime. Some in town think his death was the result of a hate crime, though it's never been formally labeled as such. Leon Laurelis, who was gay, lived in an area where local politicians and retired sports heroes reportedly felt comfortable using homophobic slurs on the local talk radio station, KXYL. One of the few people to call in a complaint about the radio show and the slur was a local business owner named Steve Harris, and he received serious pushback. Apparently, the hosts and the callers at KXYL were expecting Harris to object to the use of slurs on air. In fact, two different articles mentioned that a different local businessman had actually called in after the initial broadcast and offered that talk radio host a six-pack of beer if he'd use the same homophobic slur on air again. Reportedly, this caller said that he knew Steve Harris wouldn't be happy about the hate speech. That's why he wanted it said again. In fact, Steve Harris wasn't happy about any intolerance in Brownwood, and he tackled problems head on. Eventually, Harris would write about Leon's death in his blog and speak to the Texas Bulletin about its lack of hate crime reporting. The reporting they'd missed? It included threats on Harris's own business and the sexual assault of a local woman who was, quote, raped, apparently because the attacker knew or suspected she was a lesbian, end quote. Steve Harris was asked about his own sexuality, and he told reporters that anyone was welcome to come down to his store and ask him to his face. In the meantime, he'd keep pushing for tolerance in conservative Brown County, making his own deli and market a little oasis for the, quote, outsiders in town. He and his business partner, who was also named Steve, wanted to be seen as welcoming to all. But based on reporting in the late 1990s and early 2000s, they were up against a lot. In 1996, when Leon Laurelis was murdered, Steve Harris had only been back in Brownwood for a few years. He'd only recently opened his store, Steve's Market in Delhi, and gotten involved in local politics. As for Leon, he wasn't involved in politics, or activism, or anything that would have attracted attention. Leon had been in town for about 8 years, but he kept close to his inner circle, his work friends, and his family. According to his nieces, Arlene and Stephanie, Brown County wasn't a place where Leon felt that he could be openly gay and be safe. And based on what Steve Harris later told newspapers, Leon was right. Harris said that after he spoke up about the homophobic rants on KXYL, people drove by his store shouting slurs. Harris actually caught one of those incidents on videotape. Per the Texas Tribune, an anonymous caller actually threatened Harris and his business partner in 2001. He said, quote, I've heard you guys are homosexuals. We don't go for that sort around here. You're going to lose your business. We'll run you and your business out of this town. Stephanie, Leon Laurelis' niece, would later come across Harris's blog and read about all the issues in Brownwood. She'd only been a child when her uncle Leon was murdered, but as an adult and a librarian, she decided to do her own research into the case. Harris's blog gave her some context for the social climate in Brownwood when her uncle had been killed. She especially appreciated that, years later, Harris was still talking about Leon's homicide. She told us,
he knew that it was a hate crime, and that's what really he was advocating for, was for justice to be served. Because at the time, it was on the radio station about people that were gay need to be run out of town or whatever that went. I never heard it on the radio because I didn't live in Brownwood, so I didn't have access to the radio station. But people talked about it. You know, there was just so much hate towards gay people at the time in Brownwood. And even though my uncle's case has never been stamped a hate crime, it was a hate crime.
Steve Harris had been born and raised in Brownwood, and he had roots there. But Leon had grown up a little way south, down in Brady, Texas. Leon was the youngest child in a big family. His brothers and sisters were much older. So when he came along in 1966, those siblings were moving on to start their own families. Leon lived alone with his aging parents, and though his older brothers and sisters certainly helped out, Leon quickly took on the role of primary caregiver. According to his niece Arlene, nurturing was a natural inclination of Leon's. Arlene and Leon were only a few years apart in age, and they were raised more like cousins or even brother and sister. They were extremely close. We asked Arlene to tell us about Leon's early life.
He had a kind of a rough childhood. He was the youngest out of nine kids, and he came like later in life. So my grandparents were older, not in good health. So he didn't really have a childhood. He was mostly their caretaker. So from the time he was like, I think 14, he had to learn to drive so that he could take them to their doctor's appointments, pick up their medications, and, you know, did all that kind of stuff. He did the cooking since he was young. So he didn't really have, you know, time to be a kid or play or anything. But he and I were still close since we were, you know, close in age. He just didn't have a normal childhood. He spent his whole life taking care of other people. But he never complained, and not even once. Both of my grandparents were diabetic, and my grandmother had open heart surgery, and my grandfather had kidney transplant. And so they were like very ill, and he spent his whole life taking care of them. And he missed a lot of school, you know, just to take them to doctor's appointments out of town, because our town was so little. We didn't have specialists in our town. So he would have to travel 4 hours every week to take them to doctor's appointments and score, you know, the dialysis, because we didn't have that in town. I would go clean my grandmother's house on Saturdays, but he did most of everything, the cleaning, making sure they took their medication, the cooking, picking up their prescriptions. He did all of that.
Leon's niece, Stephanie, she's the daughter of Leon's older sister, Sally. Though much younger than Arlene and Leon, Stephanie was very close to her uncle and understood that his childhood had been difficult, but that he'd risen to the challenge.
Since he was so much younger than his siblings, he was still in the house when they became ill. And that's why my parents bought the house next door, so they could help him out with taking care of them. But he never once, even though I was so small, he never once thought of it as a burden. You know, he knew that his parents needed to be taken care of, so he stepped up and he did it.
Because of Leon's caregiving duties, Arlene and Stephanie felt that he didn't have much time to focus on his own life, whether that was school or hobbies or relationships. We asked Arlene to tell us a little bit about Leon's personality growing up, what he really enjoyed.
He was a big fan of Madonna, and so was I. But yeah, he loved music. And I think that was, I guess, his relief, since, you know, like I said, he didn't have a normal childhood or wasn't able to be a normal teenager. That was his thing. You know, he listened to music. You know, the sad thing was, I don't think that he ever felt like he had a chance to do anything in his life, because his whole life was just taking care of his parents until they passed away. And it's not that he didn't have any ambition. He just, you know, like I said, he missed a lot of school because he had to take him to doctor's appointments. He did well. It's just that he wasn't able to attend a lot, you know, especially my grandparents were sick. He had to stay home and take care of them. But his main thing is he loved cooking. He was the best cook, and he could just whip up anything out of no matter what you had. He was so great at cooking, and he loved doing that. He could have gone, you know, somewhere with that, but he didn't really have much of a chance. They didn't have any money, so he couldn't go to college. You know, it was just really hard for him.
After Leon and Arlene had graduated high school, Leon's parents, Arlene's grandparents, passed away. Arlene, who'd gotten married and had a baby, was going through a difficult divorce around that time. It seemed natural that Leon, who had a deep love of family, would offer to help her.
When I had my first son, I moved to San Angelo, where I'm at now. I didn't have a good marriage, so we were divorcing. And so he moved over there to San Angelo with me, and he lived with me so he could take care of my son, which was a year and a half old at the time. He stayed with me for almost 2 years there, taking care of my son while I worked. And then 2 years later, I had another son. We moved to Brownwood. I had a third son right after that. And so that's my grandparents had passed away. So he had moved to Brownwood with us, and he took care of all three of my boys while I worked. He was the one that taught them their ABCs, their numbers, their colors. And he worked the graveyard shift at Kroger grocery store so that he could take care of my boys during the day. He was just a selfless person. He always was there for everyone. He helped anyone that needed it, and he never complained. I mean, I'm sure it was hard for him to come home at 6 a.m. and then take care of three boys, but he loved them. You know, they were like his own, and he did it for me.
Leon was an important figure in the lives of Arlene's children and also in the lives of his other nieces and nephews, like Stephanie.
My fondest memory of him was when I would get out of school, he would pick me up and take me to the ice cream store. And it would just be him and I, and he just made it a point to spend that special quality time with me. And he knew I loved reading, and every year for my birthday, he would drive me to San Angelo, which is 77 miles away from home, to take me to the bookstore to purchase a few books for my birthday. I was at that age where my brother and sister were a little bit older than me, and they never wanted their little sister hanging around. So we did lots of fun things together.
Like Arlene, Stephanie recognized that Leon hadn't had a lot of time to develop his own passions and interests, not with all the responsibilities of his youth. But his love for music, that was something that he always shared with both of them.
He was always happy. He loved to dance. He just loved to dance. He used to have a jukebox in his room with like disco lights on the bottom. And I remember, you know, as soon as I got home from school, I dumped my stuff at my house and ran next door, and we listened to music.
Other facets of Leon's life were less known to his nieces and to the rest of his family. Leon was not living as an out gay man in Brown County, and he hadn't been in Brady either. Based on our interviews with his family and the reporting that came soon after Leon's murder, it was known to some people, whether they were friends or loved ones, that Leon was a member of the LGBTQ+ community. But it wasn't something that he openly discussed, not even with Arlene. And this is where things get a little complicated. When Leon moved in with his older brother George, he developed a social life made up mostly of friends from work. If he was dating, it wasn't something he discussed openly with his family, and they didn't know all of his friends either. There were people they were familiar with, long-standing associates from work, the people whose birthday dinners Leon would attend or who he'd meet for movies. And Arlene knew some of them, at least by name. After all, Leon would often come to the jewelry store where she worked to buy a birthday present for this coworker or that one. He was that kind of friend. He'd offer to take others shopping at the local Bell's department store where he had a credit card. Many of the employees there knew him by name. But in the last year of his life, Leon's social circle had broadened. He'd been at local parties where a number of different friend groups intermingled, and some say he'd befriended a small group of men who had a bad reputation. It was that new friend group that seemed to be the source of the rumors that popped up in the months preceding Leon's death. And those new connections also coincided with sudden stress in his life. The names of the individuals that Leon became close with, they haven't been released by law enforcement, and we won't share them here. The comments on social media make it clear that they were well known. Harris's blog mentioned them too. One person called them the Brownwood Mafia. Another poster on Facebook used the phrase, quote, "that little Northside posse." Based on the information that we've gathered, Leon was spending time with at least three young men who'd been close friends on their own for a long time. It has been alleged that at least one of these individuals is the son of a prominent member of the Brownwood community, the sort of person who would have been in a position of power at the time of Leon's death. Arlene and Stephanie don't know how or why Leon befriended these individuals. We've been told the persons in question were rumored to be involved in dangerous illegal activities. Absolutely none of that would have interested Leon, as far as his family knows. Leon had never been in any kind of trouble, but they also know that he was kind and would have offered friendship to anyone who sought him out. But that begs the question, did they seek Leon out? And if so, why? So far as Leon's family knows, these new friends didn't have any outward ties to the gay community. The rumors surrounding them had more to do with illegal activities, though those specifics are vague. How Leon met them is unknown. Perhaps at those same local parties where, as Stephanie told us, people from all walks of life and age groups might show up. Here's what Arlene told us about Leon's new friends.
I only knew his work friends. If he had friends outside of that, I didn't know them. But before all this happened, I did hear rumors where he was hanging around some other guys that were probably not the best kind of people to be hanging out with, which was news to me because he wasn't that kind of a person. He never, you know, was never in trouble. He didn't make waves. He always had to try to please everyone. No, he wasn't a rowdy kind of person at all.
The rumors about Leon's new friends also coincided with Leon's first real adult freedom. The first time he didn't have direct caregiving duties when he could go out or drive into the next town with friends to visit bars or restaurants and enjoy some of the youth his family worried that he'd missed out on. So to give Leon extra privacy around this time felt totally natural. But this privacy also meant that his closer confidants, like Arlene, might have known less about what he was doing than they otherwise would. According to Stephanie, there weren't gay bars in the sense that most of us living in metro areas would expect to find. But there were establishments that were considered gay-friendly, outside of Bangs or Brownwood, where Leon might have gone. We asked Arlene how much she and Leon spoke about his social life in 1996.
I just felt like, you know, it was probably time for him to have his own friends and, you know, find out what he wanted to do and what he liked to do because he never had that chance before. So I didn't ask him. And our family's not that kind of family that you talk about your feelings or anything. So that kind of stuff wasn't really discussed because, you know, I had a feeling that he was gay, but no one ever asked him. I mean, it didn't bother me at all. So I didn't care. It was his life. I loved him no matter what. So I never asked him. And he never, he may have been dealing with, you know, because our family's Catholic. So I'm sure it was really hard for him. He was probably dealing with that too. So I never really questioned him, you know.
24 years later, it seems clear that these two social threads are distinct. Leon had begun to quietly explore his identity as a gay man, and Leon had made friends with several individuals who were involved in some aspects of the Brown County underworld. From the outside, these two factors do not seem immediately intertwined. But eventually, Leon's family would hear more rumors that these same new friends may have been directly involved in Leon's murder. If that was true, how did it all connect? And did any of this have an impact on the investigation into Leon's death? The more Leon's family has discovered, the more they wonder if someone from that underworld found out that Leon was gay and didn't like it. Or perhaps that Leon, suddenly exposed to illegal activity through his new associates, saw something that they later decided that he shouldn't have, and that he was silenced before he could decide to tell the story. We spoke to Leon's niece, Stephanie, about some of these possibilities. Could the entire friendship have been a setup aimed at Leon? Based on what Steve Harris would later tell newspapers, the area certainly had issues with deep-seated homophobia.
Did you get the impression that these men had befriended your uncle under false pretenses in order to hurt him?
No, I don't believe so. I was told that it had happened because something had happened that he had seen and they didn't approve of that.
That idea comes up in the official report too. Numerous news articles make mention that in the weeks before his death, Leon had been worried about something. According to the Brownwood Bulletin, he'd spoken about people being angry with him, but he hadn't been specific. And he hadn't told his relatives why exactly anyone would have been upset. Arlene was able to verify this for us. Though if she'd known before Leon's death, she would have pushed him for more information.
At that point, he hadn't shown any concern or told me anything yet. And I didn't know this till later, but 2 days before he was murdered, he did tell his sister, the one that was, you know, next to the youngest to him, that he that there were some people that were mad at him and wanted to hurt him. And he didn't know why. Because again, like, you know, he's never done anything mean, so he had no clue why. And my aunt didn't really, I don't know if she didn't take him seriously or just said, you know, oh, you'll be okay. Nobody had told me this. So to this day, it just tears me up. Like, why didn't he tell me? I would have, you know, said, come and stay with me or something. But he didn't tell me. And, you know, for him to speak up about it, he must have been really scared because, again, we don't talk about our feelings or our worries in our family. For him to go to his sister and say that, he must have been really scared. And there's been speculation that he saw something that he shouldn't have, and that may be why, or because they found out he was gay. Those are the only two reasons that we have been able to come up with. Because he never said that he, like, did anything for somebody to be mad at him. He said, I don't know why, but they want to hurt me.
Leon's problems didn't keep him from his work, even though that lonely drive down to the Kroger for his graveyard shift must have felt a little more frightening in the days preceding his death. As far as we know, his coworkers knew nothing of his problems. Like his family, they seemed to have heard rumors after the fact. But on the night of May 10th, 1996, things seemed normal. We'll go back to that moment, to the last time Leon left for work, to talk about how his family discovered what happened and how the crime was investigated. Arlene walked us through Leon's nightly routine.
Okay, so since he worked the graveyard shifts at Kroger, he lived a little bit out of town, so he was a very punctual. He would like to arrive early. So he left like at 11:30 p.m. at night to go to work. From what I was told, he did arrive at Kroger and somebody parked next to him and then he left. So I'm assuming it was these new friends or whomever that said, hey, come out and meet us here. So when he left, they drove out into the, like, pretty much the middle of nowhere. And then after that, the 911 call came in at 12:30 a.m. that there was a car on fire. So between 11:30 p.m. and 12:30 a.m. is when this happened. This is really hard for me because that same day, he went to Walmart. That's where I worked. When I got off of work, I went into the parking lot to go to my car, and I saw his car there. And for a second, I thought, should I go back in and see what he's doing? But I had a rough day, and I was really tired, so I just went home. And to this day, it kills me that I did not go back in to see him one last time. It haunts me to this day.
We've told you that Leon's body was discovered beside his burning car at roughly 12:30 a.m., just about 30 minutes after he was to begin his shift, and not long after motorists had seen his Thunderbird driving slowly up the shoulder of the rural farm road, trailed by a pickup truck. By the early morning hours, a call had come in to Leon's brother, George. His address, of course, was on Leon's license. Soon, calls were made to all the siblings, including Stephanie's mother, Sally, who was living back in their hometown of Brady. Stephanie told us about what it was like to get that news.
It was the day of our senior trip, or my senior trip, and I knew I had to get up early to leave because we were going to go to Dallas to go to Six Flags. And my dad went in the room and woke me up, and I turned around and I looked at the time, and I knew something was wrong because just nobody ever wakes you up at that time of night. And we all got in the car and drove to Brownwood. We were all just in shock that we couldn't believe that it had happened. We just couldn't understand why somebody would do this to him. Sorry.
Arlene was asleep at home with her own children, but she can still remember the moment when she answered the phone.
It was about 2:30 in the morning when I got a phone call, and my cousin just blurted out, "Someone killed Leon." And I'm like, "What? What are you talking about?" And she repeated it. I'm like, no, that can't be true. And I just remember, like, I guess the phone fell from my hand and I was just crying. It's like, this can't be true.
As they headed into Brownwood to speak with the sheriff, the family had very little information. For some of the family, it felt like that lack of communication of information would become a pattern. Here's what Arlene remembers about that first morning.
It was, the worst Mother's Day weekend ever. I remember that day it rained all day long. I got dressed and I went to the sheriff's department and they didn't know anything. They wouldn't tell us anything. And then somebody told me it's already in the newspaper. So I went to go get the newspaper and there was this picture. And nobody had even told us anything yet. And it was already there for everyone to see. And I was so angry. I even went over to the newspaper and I yelled at them, "How dare you do this?" When they haven't even told us anything. They hadn't told us at that time how he was killed. He was killed execution style in the back of the head as he was kneeling down. We did not know this, and it was in the newspaper. I was so angry.
Considering that Leon had lived such a quiet life and been so popular with his small social circle at Kroger, we asked Stephanie what their initial thoughts were when they found out that he'd been shot. It was established fairly early on that Leon's car had made it to the Kroger that night. His coworkers had seen it. Then it disappeared, and then it reappeared on that farm road near the gun range, where witnesses had seen the white truck just before Leon's Thunderbird was set ablaze. Here's what Stephanie told us.
We knew it had to have been somebody he knew because he was going to work, and he did park in the Kroger parking lot.
So you knew he had been taken by someone else to the gun range area?
Yes, because my uncle was never late for work. Never. He was always on time. And if he was going to be late because he drove an older car, he made sure my uncle took him to work, or because he lived with his brother at the time. But he was always punctual, and just for him not to go inside of Kroger or whoever it was waiting in his vehicle at his house. But I don't see him parking at Kroger if somebody was already in his car. But there are people that saw him park at Kroger and they wondered why he never came inside. So it had to have been somebody he knew for him to leave with. Something that I have always thought about is, I know it has to be more than one person that had done this, because my uncle was a very large man. He was very, very tall and heavy set. And he also wasn't fearful. Even though there were a lot of things that he was concerned about, you know, like because he lost both of his parents when he was so young, it made him see life differently.
Stephanie also wondered whether Leon drove his own car out to the gun range or whether someone else drove it there for him. Had he gone there of his own volition and then been attacked, or could he have been forced to drive there? Or perhaps forced into a third car with a third person driving Leon's Thunderbird out to the farm road.
And I've always wondered, like, where was the position of his seat in the car? Because any other person driving would have to move the seat. But since my uncle was such a large man, his seat was always pushed all the way back and reclined so he could fit. And there are very few people his size.
This brings us to the investigation, the media coverage surrounding Leon's death, and what the last 25 years have brought. At the time of Leon's murder, there were a few articles published, though local papers didn't cover the story for long. The investigation was open, but leads seemed to dry up pretty quickly, even though rumors around town said that, as we mentioned, those new friends of Leon's might have been involved. It's worth noting, again, that one of those new friends was alleged to be related to an important person in the community. Arlene described to us what her family was told in the early days of the investigation.
You know, they told us they couldn't find anything because his car was set on fire, so that destroyed a lot of evidence. So it was just all very strange, and we never got any answers. And so we decided as a family to hire a private investigator ourselves. And after a couple of weeks, the PI said that there was a lot of corruption in the town and that a lot of people he tried to talk to were scared, and so they didn't want to talk. He himself had been threatened, and so he said he couldn't continue.
Leon's family recently reached out to the PI who'd been on the case, and though he did acknowledge remembering it, he did not speak with us for this podcast. We asked Stephanie how much she heard at the time of Leon's murder regarding suspects and what was being done, and how much she's heard since.
times were different back then, and being Hispanic also, if adults are talking, you're not in the room, sort of. Even though I was a senior in high school, I was still just a kid. And it was too much for me, too, because my uncle was my world. He was literally my best friend growing up because my dad worked 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. So, you know, we had all that time together. And I kind of shut down from people. So I never allowed myself to really hear things either because it hurt too much.
Some information did surface in the months after the investigation. Although it has never been publicly verified by a law enforcement source, it did come out in the wake of the PI's investigation and the town's reaction to Leon's death. If you'll recall, Leon had a credit card for the department store Bell's, which is a lot like a Sears or Belk or JCPenney. According to Leon's family, he was a regular shopper there. And as we mentioned, he'd sometimes take friends along to shop and even treat them to gifts. It stands to reason that multiple people would know that Leon both had this card and that he used it to purchase things for others. According to a source we spoke with, there was talk that Leon's Bell's card was used the day after his death. That same source was told that when the store, or perhaps when police, tried to check security footage to see who'd used the card, the footage was no longer available. We weren't able to speak with the sheriff to verify this information, so we don't know if Leon's card was used. But if the theft did occur right after his death, it's an important clue. Since the Brown County Sheriff's Office turned down our FOIA requests and hasn't responded to our request for comment or interview, that's as much detail as we have on the possibility of the Bell's card theft. The Brown County Sheriff's Office has had this case for a long time. In fact, five sheriffs have come and gone since Leon Lareles was murdered, a lot of different people in one office. It was back in 2008 when the sheriff was Bobby Grubbs. There seemed to be some movement in the case. According to the Abilene Reporter News, Grubbs had been a Texas Ranger at the time of Leon's murder and had been involved in working the case back in 1996. The headline of this particular article reads, quote, Brown County authorities find leads in 96 killing. The article makes mention of, quote, new information that the sheriff declined to elaborate on, but also mentions that in 2005, Leon's case had been handed over to the Texas Rangers Cold Case Squad, along with the other unsolved murder in the Brown County area. That death, the murder of a 13-year-old girl, Amanda Goodman, also remains open. She was found on another rural roadway, roughly 15 miles from where Leon's body was discovered. Another 2008 article provides a little more detail. The Brownwood Bulletin quotes both Sheriff Grubbs and a Sergeant Simpson, who say that new information that emerged in 2007 led them to focus on several specific people. But they declined to name these people or to call them suspects. Simpson told the Bulletin, quote, there were persons of interest that the sheriff directed me toward to either get them eliminated as persons of interest or to go forward. They have not been able to be eliminated as persons of interest in this case. They are the focal point of this investigation. Both articles included quotes from Stephanie's Uncle George, who is Leon's brother. His exhaustion and frustration comes through clearly in the lines. He told the Bulletin, quote, I'm just hoping to have it solved one day, and hoping it will be soon. We've been waiting a long time for this. I don't think it's a case that cannot be solved. It's very hard, but we've got to keep hoping. But Sheriff Grubbs passed away in 2015, and both Leon and Amanda's cases were still open. According to a 2016 article in the Brownwood Bulletin, all three of the candidates who ran to replace him in office were asked how they would handle these cases. The eventual winner, Vance Hill, had this to say, quote, I'm sure if there's something that can keep a man from resting in peace, it would be those two cases. Sheriff Grubbs tried everything that he could possibly do to solve those two cases. I assure you, these cases are not dead. They weigh on us. We're still investigating them, and hopefully, one of these days, something will turn up on these two cases. But the last 4 years have been quiet. There was a brief article published by KTXS ABC 12 in February of 2020 asking for anyone with any information on Leon's case to come forward. This article mentioned that Leon was gay and that his murder may have been a hate crime, but still, with no extra context from law enforcement that could help explain exactly what he may have been afraid of in May of 1996. Or what, if anything, could have slowed down that initial investigation. That same February, there was also a posting on Facebook by a Central Texas crime page about Leon's case. The comment section was flooded by friends and coworkers who, after 24 years, still remember him clearly. Here are just a few of the things that they had to say. Leon was a nice person. We all loved him. Kroger employees will never forget him. I worked with him. Such a friendly guy. This is sad. I remember hearing this after moving back to Texas. Don't let me find you, whoever did this. An eye for an eye. I remember seeing him in the Krogers, always smiling and helpful. It was sad to hear of his tragic death. Someone knows something and needs to come forward. According to a Crime Stoppers bulletin released in 1996, $1,000 was offered for information in the case. That same bulletin also mentions that the Kroger Corporation had offered another $1,000. But so far, Stephanie's been unable to verify that those funds still exist. For the last year, Stephanie's been trying to get billboards put up where the now-closed Kroger stood, hoping to jog the memories of people who knew Leon, who might be willing to call with information. After all, it's been 24 years. Maybe folks will be less frightened than they were back then. Maybe the family could finally understand why this happened to Leon. Because he was gay? Because he saw something he wasn't intended to? Whatever that might be. Maybe for both reasons. Whatever the answer, Stephanie thinks billboards could help, but she says she can't get the company to call her back. So the billboards sit empty, with no advertisements plastered on them. Like everything else in this case, it feels like an endless waiting game. But it's a game that Leon's family won't give up. They know that, no matter what, Leon would never give up on them. Here's what Stephanie told us.
My main focus is trying to get it out there. And I think if we can just push it, then they'll have to say they did it because it's not going to come out of their face. They've only been able to get away with it so long because it was just thrown in the back burner and nobody cared anymore.
Leon's memory stays with Arlene and Stephanie. It's what pushes them to pursue justice nearly 25 years later, to find out why someone would have killed their gentle, kind, generous uncle. What secrets would have seemed worth a human life? So much time has passed, maybe someone will be brave enough to tell the truth. Arlene and Stephanie hold on to that hope. While we were working on this episode, Arlene sent us an email that ended with this thought, and we wanted to share it with our listeners. Here's what she wrote. A few years ago, I held a memorial for him. Someone had taken a picture of where I'd placed a white cross in the area where this happened. And in the picture, there was the most beautiful rainbow directly above his cross. I know he's always with me. He visits me in my dreams sometimes, and those are the times that I feel so happy that he visited me. And I feel sad that I can't talk to him and tell him how happy that made me. If you have any information regarding the murder of Leon Laurelis, whose full name is Juan Leon Laurelis, please call Heart of Texas Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477. There's a $1,000 reward in this case. Thank you for listening to The Fall Line. As of 2021, The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support for our sponsors and for the podcast. You help us do research, obtain FOIAs, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. There, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blog posts and videos. We have started several major fundraising efforts, including a therapy fund for families who've been on the show, and new billboard art for the Milberg twins, and much more. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kim Fritz, and Jessica Ann. Family and law enforcement interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced and engineered by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to the Black and Missing Foundation.